playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. What a devastating and baffling week it's been, with a catalogue of failures by the HSE leaving a trail of misery. Vicky Phelan is 43 and the mother of two small children. She's been diagnosed with cervical cancer and has less than a year to live. The backstory is appalling. 7 years ago, Vicky was given the all clear after a routine smear test. However, after a review of those tests in 2014, it was discovered that her cancer had been missed. But there was a 2 year delay before her doctor was told, and it was 3 years before Vicky herself was informed. On Wednesday, she was awarded €2.5 million against the US laboratory who'd analysed the smear tests on behalf of the cervical check screening programme. Vicky Phelan gave her reaction on the steps of the High Court.
There are no winners here today. I am terminally ill and there is no cure for my cancer. My settlement will mostly be spent on buying me time and on paying for clinical trials to keep me alive and to allow me to spend more time with my children. If I die, and I truly hope that won't be the case, the money will provide for my family. The women of Ireland can no longer put their trust in the cervical check programme. Mistakes can and do happen, but the conduct of cervical check and the HSE in my case is unforgivable. To know for almost 3 years that a mistake had been made and that I was misdiagnosed is bad enough, but to keep that information from me until I became terminally ill and to drag me through the courts to fight for my right to the truth is an appalling breach of trust. And I truly hope that some good will come of this case and that there will be an investigation into the cervical check programme as a result of this. Thank you.
Vicky's solicitor, Kino Carroll, spoke with Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
There was a 90% chance that had she been treated properly in 2011, she would have lived well into her 80s and had a perfectly normal life, and only a small chance that she would have had some modest reduction in her life expectancy. And instead, now here she is at 43 years of age with a husband, two young children, and I'm very sorry to say, but a very bleak future.
Meanwhile, the HSE went into damage limitation mode and the big guns were rolled out. Dr. Jerome Coffey is a radiation oncology consultant and director of the National Cancer Control Programme. He spoke with Gavin Jennings.
Patients are made aware once they have a cancer diagnosis that the order process is there, that the information is made available to their physician and they can get that information from their physician.
How would a patient know if a mistake was made if they weren't told? You're saying that the current procedure is that if a mistake is made, the treating physician is told, but is there any obligation to tell the patient?
There is. First of all, the word diagnosis has to be addressed here. Screening looks for abnormalities. It doesn't diagnose cancer.
Yes.
When a person has cancer, there's a look back process where there's any concern, and that the information from that look back is sent to the treating physician, and that's the process, getting as much information to the
patient
as possible. The process is that the physician has the information to share with the patient, but it's important to say the patient is aware the review process is there and can.
Is there an obligation to tell the patient?
There is, the process is as described.
Is there an obligation to tell the patient? Does the patient have to be informed if a review shows that a mistake was made?
That is between the physician and the patient.
That sounds like a no to me.
I don't know what the statistics are and how many physicians have spoken to how many patients, but the information is made available to the physician to discuss that with the patient.
It also appears from the correspondence in this case that there were a number of other patients for whom there were concerns in this 2014 review. Have they been told?
To my knowledge, all information from the review to date has been, and as recently as February this year, has been communicated to the treating physicians.
Have the patients been told?
I don't have that information.
Do you know how many patients are involved?
I know that this process is an ongoing process. We know that all cases diagnosed so far, the look back has completed, and looking into the future, as soon as we know of a
this
case.
This is a 2014 audit. Do you know how many patients were affected? We know Vicky Phelan was. How many other cases were there where there were mistakes made or concerns raised?
I don't have those figures here.
As the debate about the cervical screening programme ratcheted up and ethical and moral questions arose on the patient's right to know, the Minister for Health, Simon Harris, said he had no confidence in the management of cervical check as fresh failures emerged relating to 206 women. Professor Gráinne Flannelly, Clinical Director of Cervical Check, was asked by Gavin Jennings if those patients had been informed.
My sense is that the patients have been told.
Your sense is, do you know if the patients have been told? Or more to the point, why haven't your programme told the patients?
Well, the Ireland clinicians mainly are colposcopists who work as part of the cervical check programme. So they are all cervical check doctors. So from our perspective,
do you know this morning for sure if these 206 patients are aware of this?
I can't tell you for sure that the 206 patients are aware of it.
From yesterday's Morning Ireland. Meanwhile, Taoiseach Simon Coveney has apologised to Vicky Phelan on behalf of the government, describing her case as a shameful series of events. And Health Minister Simon Harris has proposed patient safety legislation to include mandatory open disclosure of serious events. As if that story wasn't enough grief for one week, there was yet another example of system failure. In April 2016, RTÉ Investigates revealed the case of a foster home scandal in County Galway involving three girls under 10. At the time of the report, a man had been charged with rape and sexual assault of the girls. Recently, he was found guilty and sentenced to 7.5 years in prison with a year suspended. On Tuesday of this week, RTÉ Investigates broadcast a follow-up programme on which some of the young women at the centre of the case waived their anonymity so that their abuser, 29-year-old Keith Burke of Adair Gualmore, Dunmore, County Galway, could be named. Rachel Barry is one of those brave women. She's now 22, but when she was 8 years old, she was sent for monthly respite care to the home of Kathleen and Jerry Burke. And a warning, this is not suitable for sensitive ears.
Keith called Amy upstairs and asked Amy to ask me to go to the hut to play. In the hut there was a bed. Myself and Amy in turns had to strip down with nothing, only our socks on. And while he obviously had done it to Amy before, he called her over and I had to watch what was happening to her.
RTÉ Investigates reporter Aoife Hegarty detailed how the case was handled when she spoke with Rachel English. And again, this comes with a health warning.
In May 2007, some 2 years after she started going to the Burke foster home, Rachel told her biological mother that she had been sexually abused by Keith Burke. The HSE, who had responsibility for child protection at that time, subsequently investigated her allegations and they assessed that Rachel's disclosure was credible. Now, at that time, Rachel reported that Amy, who had been living with the Burkes for a decade at that time, had also been raped by Keith Burke. But out of fear, Amy didn't come forward and disclose any abuse. The Gardaí sent a file to the DPP, but no prosecution followed. Now, we've seen documentation that shows despite Rachel's credible allegation, the HSE decided that Amy and another long-term foster child, a boy, would stay in the Burke foster home, but that any contact between Keith Burke and the children was to be supervised.
So what happened next then?
Well, if we move 4 years on to October 2011, Amy did find the courage to come forward and she told a teacher that she too had been raped by Keith Burke. Remember, Rachel had told the authorities that was the case and when she had made her own allegation 4 years earlier and in those intervening years, Amy had been left in the foster home. Now, Amy's disclosure prompted a new Garda investigation and in 2013, as part of that investigation, the Garda made another shocking discovery when they found a third victim. And that victim we just called tonight Sarah in our report. And she came forward as another rape victim of Keith Burke. Sarah had been placed into foster care as well with Kathleen and Jerry Burke back in 2000 when she was just 5 years old. And just like Rachel, she too witnessed Amy being repeatedly raped.
The case went to trial last year, Aoife. Was it contested?
Yeah, well, when the three girls came forward, that led the DPP to press charges on over 70 counts of sexual abuse. When the case did come to court, that was reduced to 39 sample charges. And last July, following a 9-day trial, Keith Burke was found guilty on 23 of those charges. But throughout the entire case, Keith Burke pleaded not guilty, meaning Amy, Sarah and Rachel were forced to take the stand and give evidence. And tonight they recount how traumatic an experience that was for them. Just a fortnight ago at his sentence hearing, Keith Burke did eventually admit his guilt. He was sentenced, he was given 7.5 years for the rape charges and concurrent terms of 6.5 and 5 years for the remaining charges. The final year was suspended. It was an outcome that really has left the girls distraught, and they very much feel that the sentence doesn't equal the crime and what they're going to have to live with for the rest of their lives.
From Tuesday's Morning Ireland, and the issue was also raised on The Gathering yesterday by Richard Curran.
Dara O'Brien, this is about system failure.
Yes.
And also we saw during the week the horrendous example, again relating to the system, on RTE's primetime of three children now, women who were failed by the system and experienced horrible abuse while living in a foster home in County Galway.
It's been just awful. And just in relation to Tulsa, this is something that you would have thought you were reading about 30 years ago. This is a modern day Ireland. This cannot be allowed to happen ever. And there is no reason for it, because the protection, the child protection laws are in place there. It's about their application. And when you see a situation like that with those three young girls and what they were put through by that animal, and the state knowing about it, it just beggars belief. But what next week, now we need to move on and say, well, what we're going to do about it.
Fianna Fáil's Dara O'Brien heard on the Today Show yesterday. The award-winning writer Pat McCabe was Sean Rock's guest on Arena. His latest novel, Heartland, is set deep in the Midlands. But as Sean remarked, there's more than a whiff of the Wild West in it too.
So somewhere in between is the psychic landscape of the Wild West and the rural kind of peat bog landscape, somewhere maybe could be anywhere between Coal Island and deepest Offaly.
And it is that Midlands aspect that's vitally important. How real a world is it?
It's not a real world. It's the psychic imagination. The best way I can describe it is the deep south of the Irish mind. If it's real, it exists in the landscape of the language, because as we all know that the Irish vernacular was transported to America and became hillbilly talk. So it's in the language of Hank Williams, Johnny Cash, Jim Reeves and Larry Cunningham.
And Larry Cunningham is definitely in there amongst those American names. Mm. Would Big Tom be in there? He's mentioned in the book.
Of course he would. I would like to think that in the great songs, in all the great songs which Hank Williams and Dylan described as oak door songs, that, you know, as trends come and go and tides ebb and swell, that human emotions remain pretty much the same now as they did in the time of Homer. And it's like an impish conceit, where you buy array these characters in a garment of language which they would never remotely possibly use, because in its own way it's too poetic and too articulate. But if you surrender to that conceit from the get-go, you understand the book. If you're resistant to it and insist on realism, you might as well throw the book away.
Just to stick with the Big Tom mention for a moment, obviously he died last week. Do you think he tapped into that? I mean, I was watching grown men crying on the news about the death of this man. Do you think that he helped people tap into emotions with his music in the way you're speaking about there?
I just would be a little bit cautious about overlaying the sentiment. I think that Big Tom and all the great musicians deal with complex emotions. You know, it's not just about people crying, because we all die, and, you know, nobody knows that more than farming folk who are, you know, profoundly unsentimental in their day-to-day living. So my contention and my hope would be that Big Tom and Hank Williams and all these people, I mean, Big Tom has many, many songs about many, many things, and to me it's not about a death of an old way of life or anything else. I'm not a sentimental person that way. Big Tom will go on living long after the people, you know, who are commenting on him are gone. And his songs will live on. And, you know, he talks about love, he talks about death, he talks about heartbreak, and he talks about happiness. So the tear, while it's justified at a graveside, obviously, it's only part of the story.
Pat McCabe with Sean Rocks on Wednesday Night Serena. Well, Pat's stories are often described as surreal, but there was an air of unreality in the real world yesterday as the leaders of North and South Korea embraced and pledged to work for complete denuclearisation of the Korean Peninsula. Richard Curran couldn't resist getting the reaction of independent TD John Halligan, who in the past had planned to lead a peace mission to North Korea himself.
John Halligan, we've been seeing all morning the historic pictures of North Korea and Kim Jong-un and South Korea. It looks like peace is breaking out without you. They fixed it without you, John.
Well, they heard he was coming over maybe, and they said we have to sort this out. Maybe we helped initiate it.
Look, it's a good story in the sense that this was a desperate situation in North Korea and the threats that were being made from both sides by both America and North Korea. I always thought it was inevitable that peace would overcome threats.
Are you sorry you didn't go?
Sure, look, I would have liked to have gone, but it may be on a holiday now.
From the Today Show yesterday. Well, there was speculation again this week that President Michael D. Higgins will seek a second term in the park after he told the Irish Independent that he'd never run from a contest in his life. Well, a presidential candidate from another time, Chernobyl campaigner A.D. Roach, told Ryan Tuberty about the nightmare she had when her 1997 bid began to unravel.
And I got the impression that you had a rough ride.
Oh, do you know what? I met me Waterloo, as they say, in 1997. All I can just say, and I still see Sean's face, the two of us when we started, it was great joy and expectation.
What a talk of you being
and it was
president.
Going to be the presidency of children, and we'd all these great ideas, you know, treating all the children of the nation equally, going back to the constitution,
cherish the children,
all of that, and a great campaign team around me. But I suppose I went from the height of that to the depths of really deep despair. There was a very serious smear campaign against me at the time, and I just wasn't able for the mental torture of it, I suppose, really. I wasn't able for that kind of rough ride of it. I just went under. I absolutely sank. Just couldn't fight back. That's what I learned about myself, really, that, you know, while I can fight for the causes and things like that, but inside of myself, I couldn't fight for myself. And, you know, I just couldn't survive the cut and thrust viciousness, I suppose, of politics. And,
you know, cruel?
It was incredibly cruel. And the impact on my family was awful. My father was diagnosed as a result with an accelerated form of Alzheimer's. He went from being campaigned to me on his bicycle all around Clonmel, where I'm from, to actually having to be put into care within like an 8-week period. And my mother lost 3 stone in weight. My brother was the sacrificial lamb. My brother, who has an ongoing case
that's
of
50 ongoing,
years,
yeah,
that's
yeah,
ongoing.
Yeah.
Anyway, all of that.
When you're in a campaign like that and the country's watching you, where do you go? Where do you go physically? Where did you go?
Well, where did I go? Well, thanks to Ali Hewson.
Sean,
my husband and I both lived with Ali in Bono for, we said, those 2 months. So that was our refuge. We'd go home there at night time and I would just disintegrate. I disintegrated.
A.D. Roach with Ryan Tuberty on Thursday. Well, it was a great week for lovers of poetry. Poetry Day Ireland celebrations on Thursday featured more than 100 imaginative events and gorgeous surprises in cafes, libraries and on buses, darts and even petrol stations up and down the country. And the poetry programme on RT Radio 1 was pure balm. Yvonne Boland was Olivia O'Leary's guest, one of Ireland's finest. She read Nightfeed, a poem you can see on a plaque in Merrion Square overlooking Hollis Street Maternity Hospital.
Nightfeed. This is dawn, believe me. This is your season, little daughter. The moment daisies open, the hour mercurial rainwater makes a mirror for sparrows. It's time we drowned our sorrows. I tiptoe in. I lift you up, wriggling in your rosy, zipped sleeper. Yes, this is the hour for the early bird and me, when finder is keeper. I crook the bottle, how you suckle. This is the best I can be, housewife to this nursery where you hold on, dear life. A silt of milk, the last sack, and now your eyes are open, birth-coloured and offended. Earth wakes, you go back to sleep. The feed is ended. Worms turn, the stars go in. Even the moon is losing face. Poplars stilt for dawn. And we begin the long fall from grace. I tuck you in.
Babies, cots, bottles, washing machines, words and images from the humdrum of female domestic life woven into poetic offerings. But as Yvonne told Olivia O'Leary, she had to battle a culture to prove that the so-called banal could also be beautiful.
And you succeeded in doing that.
Well, partly, but I know I remember being young and a young woman with small kids and thinking to myself, you know, it would be much easier to have a political murder in an Irish poem than a washing machine. I mean, you know, there's going to be that distance between subject matter and what you write about, and how, in a funny way, looking back now, I think you're a lucky poet if you have a devalued subject matter, which, of course, is what I had. It doesn't always feel like that at the time, but, you know, it made me have to think about what you put into the poem and what you left out of the poem, and how the poem you had was in conversation with other parts of things. There was an awful lot of Irish poetry that I might criticise on those grounds that I still loved, that, and I do still love, and I value those things immensely, but some of them were exclusionary.
So when you wrote about the life of the kitchen and the washing machine and gathering the children in for the night, was there resistance to it?
Yes. I mean, I didn't take it personally. I don't take it personally to this day. The resistance went all the way from outrage to dismissal, because so many people felt that what I was doing was a kind of social engineering, bringing in subjects and diluting a powerful canon. And I thought that was a very bardic response. I mean, you know...
How do you mean bardic?
Well, the thing that you look for in every tradition is not the changing of the poem, but the changing of the poet. You know, traditions that can't allow for another kind of poet are going to have difficulties. And I felt that the tradition, they might accept that a woman poet could write a good poem, but they couldn't accept she would be an Irish poet. And that, I felt, was where the dialogue opened and didn't often continue as it should have.
Yvan Boland heard on the poetry programme Sundays at 7:30 here on RT Radio 1. Well, you know what they say, nostalgia ain't what it used to be. Back in the glory days of music festivals, we were more than happy to wallow in the fields of mud, eating free curry and mung dal from the Hare Krishna tent as we stood in the lashing rain, watching our favourite bands perform in places like Listunvarna, Ballisodare, and of course, the trip to Tip. Well, the good news is that the trip to Tip is about to be revived, but it's going posh. The lead singer of Something Happens, Tom Dunn, told a delighted Christopher McKevitt all about the plan.
It's going to be the stunning Hot House Flowers and Emotional Fish, Something Happens, the four of us, Frank and Waters. I'm working on new special guests as well. Great excitement about it.
Many of us, of course, who enjoyed the music live are all possibly, many of us, I'm saying, in our 40s or 50s, even older. Are we the crowd that you want back?
Yes, is the short answer. But I think a lot of that crowd will probably have children as well, who'll be in their late teens, early 20s, who I think would also benefit from a trip down memory lane to see the kind of music their parents were into.
What are you telling us about the comforts that us older people might enjoy?
Yeah, it's going to be a very different kettle of fish. It's a fully seated gig. The seating is in the new stand, which looks out onto the pitch, and the stage will be on the pitch and playing towards the stand. So completely rain will not make any impression on us whatsoever. It's going to be very luxurious. There'll be pop-up food tents, Prosecco tents,
oh, good Lord.
Gin, all the modern accoutrements of the modern-day festival.
And the latest in Portaloos.
Exactly. State-of-the-art Portaloos.
'Tis far from state-of-the-art Portaloos we were aired. Tom Dunn there heard on Tuesday's News at 1. Well, another blast from the past. Mick Jagger was Miriam O'Callaghan's guest last Sunday. He and his band, the Rolling Stones, will play Croker next month. He recalled his last visit here at Slane Castle with the Chieftains.
I remember the Slane shows really well because it was such a beautiful setting and so such a great, you know, night, the last one I remember. And such a beautiful evening. It rained and then it became really night, beautiful later on. And then I remember the Chieftains were playing there on one of those Slane shows.
Mm.
That was a very good night in Slane.
Actually, you have sung The Long Black Veil with the Chieftains on the album of the same name.
I did. Yeah, I did do that. I do it sometimes at parties on the piano.
It's a beautiful song and it's a beautiful version you do on that album.
Thank you. That's very kind of you.
Ten years ago, on a cold, dark night, there was someone killed neath the town hall light. Just a few at the scene. And they all did agree that the man who ran looked a lot like me. Well, the judge said, son, what's your alibi? If you're somewhere else, well, you don't have to die. And I spoke not a word, though it meant my life. I'd been in the arms of my best friend's wife.
The legend that is Mick Jagger heard on Sunday with Miriam. Well, this week, Patrick Dowdall and his son, former Sinn Féin councillor Jonathan Dowdall, who were serving time for the false imprisonment and torture of Alex Hurley, had their sentences reduced on appeal. The Dowdalls lured Alex to their home on the Navan Road in Dublin on suspicion that he was trying to defraud them. And when Alex Hurley arrived at the house, they imprisoned him, tied him to a chair, shaved his head, waterboarded him, and threatened to pull off his fingers one by one with the pliers. The entire ordeal was filmed by a third party. On Tuesday's Liveline, Alex Hurley gave his first ever interview about what happened at the Dowdall home back in January 2015.
Did they actually shave your head with an electric razor?
Yes, they did.
And what in the name of good God were they attempting to do?
I don't know. I think it was all part of their agendas. You know, the torture that they wished to inflict.
Did you think you were going to die?
Yes.
Did you say to them, please don't kill me?
Yes, I did, yes.
And what did they say?
They said, you're not going anywhere. You're not leaving here alive.
Because, as you know, when Jonathan Dowdall's house was subsequently searched, and it was a high-profile search and lots of publicity,
correct.
He came on Liveline. And I think he'd been on it before as an inner-city Sinn Féin councillor. Would you mind if we let people hear his voice again, Alex? I don't want to be upsetting you.
No, that's fine.
OK, well, let's listen to Jonathan Dowdall. This is the man who you were convinced was about to kill, was trying to kill you and was about to kill you.
I wasn't cautioned or arrested at any point or questioned about anything. I don't know what it's in relation to, and they wouldn't let me. If I left the room, I was held at gunpoint. I put the dogs away for them to search the house. At one point then, when we did leave, my wife came back to the house, and there was a guard sitting in the house on his own. He was sitting there on the sofa with a machine gun watching the telly. Like, my car, I do have a nice car job, but I worked my whole life from it. I'm working since the day I'm 16. If there was any criminality stuff to do with me, it would have been out during the time of the elections. The police have no... There's nothing there, Joe.
There's nothing there. He mentioned dogs, Alex. Were you aware that he had dogs?
Yes, I was aware. I was told he had dogs, that I was going to be their next meal.
How long did this ordeal last for? Can you pinpoint it? Or?
I can't specifically pinpoint it, but it was 2 hours or so.
And how did you finally get out of that place?
I was released and I was dumped in a remote part of Dublin and told to get out of Dublin and never return again. Otherwise, you'd be dead.
Alex Hurley talking to Joe about his horrific ordeal at the hands of the Dowdalls, heard on Tuesday's Liveline. Over on The Tuberty Show, Ryan's guest was Sue Black. She's a forensic anthropologist who's just published a memoir about her life and work, All That Remains, A Life in Death. Whilst a pathologist deals with the death of a person, the forensic anthropologist pieces together how they lived, unravelling their lives from death backwards. Sue was in Kosovo as part of a UN indictment team for the war crimes carried out by Radovan Karadzic. It centred around a man whose wife, her sister, mother and their 8 children, including an infant and twin boys, were killed in a rocket attack by the Serb militia as they searched for food, travelling on the back of his makeshift tractor and trailer. The father was shot and injured in the leg, but hid until night time when it was safe to come out.
Under the cover of darkness, he realised that what he was going to have to do was to be able to find what was left of the remains of his family. His concern being that if he didn't, then the roaming packs of dogs would use them as a food source. And how, you know, if you put yourself into his shoes, God forbid that we could do it. He is badly wounded and bleeding himself. He is under cover of darkness trying to find what's left of every member of his family. and then he digs a hole next to a tree and buries what he finds. Later on that year, we come forward as the indictment team working for the UN, and what we want to do is we want to exhume this grave and to be able to establish whether what he had said as a witness was in fact what had occurred, because that's what makes it powerful in the courtroom. And his biggest concern was that his God would not be able to find his family because they were all mixed together, and he wanted each one to have their own grave so that his God could find them. And so when we recovered the remains from the hole, there was enough to fill pretty much 1.5 body bags and no more. And our job was to try to establish a part of a body that would belong to each and every one of the 11 individuals. So we laid out 12 sheets in the mortuary, and we were slowly able to piece back together the individual parts of everyone. When we got to the twin 14-year-old boys, of course, we couldn't separate them, and all we had was the top part of their shoulders and upper arms. We had no other part of their body. And one of them was attached to a Mickey Mouse vest. And we said to the police, please go and ask Dad, did any of their children wear a Mickey Mouse vest? Don't say it was one of the boys or one of the twins. And when the father came back with one name of the twin who said, oh, he was absolutely obsessed with Mickey Mouse, then we were able to assign a particular name to each of the twins as well. And then we could give him back 12 body bags, which was all he ever wanted, so that he would be able to know where his wife was and each of his children by name.
Forensic anthropologist Sue Black with Ryan Tuberty. On Monday, Carlo Mann, Anthony Cassidy, was sentenced to 18 years for the rape and serious assault of a woman, which left her with a permanent brain injury. The victim's daughter spoke with Mary Wilson shortly after the sentence had been handed down.
What was it like for you to have to look at him in court today, knowing what he had done to your mother?
Oh, it's awful. It's so hard to look at him. Like, the first time I ever seen him, I couldn't understand it. Like, he's so big. Like, he's massive hands. And Mammy is only, like, 5'5". And at the time, she would have only weighed about 6.5 stone. So if he had wanted just to do what he'd done to her, he could have held her down. There was no need for the severe beating that she got that night. It's so hard because when I look at him, he just looks like a normal man. And you don't think someone like normal could do something so horrific and so bad to somebody else.
How is your mother now?
She's in Dunleary at the moment. She's learning how to try and walk and to talk and do stuff for herself. She's kind of solely reliant on me to do stuff for her, which wouldn't be like her, and she doesn't like that because she was always such an outgoing and independent woman. I used to live across the road from her, and like, I have a car and she doesn't, and she'd walk to Tesco and carry up 10 bags without, just so she wouldn't have to ask me for help. Like,
from Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Monday. About 3 years ago, Surika Pollock began a fascinating series in the Irish Times called New to the Parish, and the idea was to reflect the increasing diversity in our country. People who'd come here and stayed for different reasons, to escape violence, to get an education, or simply because they'd fallen in love. Well, of the 150 stories she covered, 14 have now been published in a book by New Ireland called, simply, New to the Parish. Surika herself is a descendant of an immigrant. Her granddad, Stephen Pollock, knew very little about this country when he arrived as a political refugee to Belfast 70 years ago, as she told Marion Finucane.
My grandfather Stephen has quite a story. He came here in 1948, but it was a bit of a journey. He was born in Berlin in 1913 to quite a prosperous Jewish family, and he ended up renouncing that wealth and kind of that background and moving to London, and from there joined the International Brigades during the Spanish Civil War, where he was almost killed. He got a bullet in the head. And the 10 years between the Spanish Civil War and arriving in Ireland in 1948, he basically worked as an undercover courier for the Communist Party. He was a communist sympathiser. He was given a fake passport under the name of Saul Scupp, a Canadian man, and his English was so good that he was able to pretend to be Canadian and to trick people into that. He then spent time in India, actually, as well. He ended up in India. He was imprisoned there for a while, and in a way that worked to his advantage, strangely, because he was Jewish. So he waited out the war in a prison at the foothills of the Himalayas, returned to a very, very different Europe where a lot of his family would have either disappeared or have gone to Latin America and the United States. And he started working in Prague where he met a young woman called Eileen, who in 1945 had decided she was tired of living in Ireland and wanted to go do something different and moved to what was then Czechoslovakia and got a job as an English teacher. And the two of them fell in love. And they had a real whirlwind affair. But my grandfather, who was a journalist as well, he started writing in support of the United States policies and aid. And the ruling Communist Party did not take kindly to this. And the secret police turned up at his door. And in the space of a few weeks, he put my granny on a plane back to Ireland and he fled by foot over the border and arrived into a tiny little community, the tiny community of Kelswater in Ballymena. And that's where he was in 1948.
Right. And that's where your father was born.
That's where my father was born. He only spent a few years there because even though my grandmother's family, and it's worth mentioning, my grandmother's family were a very conservative Presbyterian family for a Jewish communist sympathising soon-to-be son-in-law, was son-in-law, to turn up on their doorstep. And only a few weeks previously, their heavily pregnant daughter, who had been gone for 3 years, turned up. It was quite a shock to them. But they settled there for 3 years and then they moved to London and my dad grew up in London.
Sirica Pollock, author of New to the Parish, heard on the Marion Finucane show. Actor Rex Ryan rocked up, as he'd say himself, to the Tuberty show on Tuesday. He was in flying form, having got over the preview of his one-man show Pilgrim, where he plays several characters. He and Ryan spoke about the play, the nerves and the buzz, before sharing memories of his father, Jerry Ryan, whose 8th anniversary falls on Monday. Rex said his father had a profound influence on him, and he had a few proper mad stories about Jerry's unconventional parenting.
So Dad was sort of giving me these action films that had something a bit deeper in them. And RoboCop, so I was a hyperactive lunatic of a child, and I sort of thought I was RoboCop, so I was going around laying down my own sort of law as a small 6 or 7 year old vigilante. Mm-hmm. So they had to bring me to this psychologist. She was grand. But her hypothesis at the end of our meetings was, he has to stop watching RoboCop. So I was like, this is not going to fly. And we got home that night and it just got to that moment. I go, so what are we doing here?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, we're watching RoboCop. So we just...
Of course he did.
We let Mum go to bed and we sat down and we tucked into RoboCop and then analysed it.
Yeah. And there was one other story, I don't want to go on about it, but it was caught my eye about you being in, I think it was Temple Street Children's Hospital, and you had to be left there overnight. Your folks got a call to say your man's going a bit wild. I think you might have been 4, yeah. Thereabouts. And your dad arrived in to find you doing what?
I had an army of boys and girls on drips of varying degrees of sickness in a full-blown rebellion. We were trying to take over the hospital. So we were running around the hospital, banging on doors, robbing stuff from the canteen. We had all the jelly and jams and everything. So we started a rebellion. Wasn't too violent, but we were just, it was sort of like, you will not keep us in bed.
Right.
You know?
Now another dad would come in and say, oi, son, you know, out, stop. If you ever do that again, your dad said what?
Well done. Well done. He said, bring it on. I actually got kicked out of the hospital. I got kicked out of Temple Street. I'm sort of proud to say that.
Did he say something along the lines of, you made some kids happy tonight? Was that the...
Yeah, on the way home in the car, he said, Rex, I was the leader of the rebellion. He said, you made some of those kids really happy tonight. They hadn't left their beds in a while. And yeah, that instant sticks with me. Yeah.
Rex Ryan heard on the Ryan Tuberty show. Well, the confusion surrounding Brexit and the border issue hasn't gone away, you know. And last week on The Business, Richard Curran spoke with the award-winning author Dara MacDonald. He's just written a new book called Hard Border, and it's a history of partition on this island, but it's also a memoir of Dara's own experience of living close to the divide.
Your own family was affected by the border. Your granddad had a draper's shop, and you would have had customers coming from across the border into Clonus from both traditions, Catholic and Protestant.
Yes, very much so. Yeah, in fact, my grandfather and grandmother set up the business around 1920 as the border was being formed. My father was the first of four siblings to be born in the Free State. He was born on Christmas Day in 1922. And it was a successful business in that as long as the hinterland was there and the people could continue to come in and buy in the shop. But then in the early 1970s, the border roads were closed and whatever. But I remember one particularly harrowing incident where a customer, the father of a family that did quite a bit of business with my dad, came one Sunday night and he was in a pretty distressed state. And he said that he could no longer come to our family shop because he had been threatened by loyalist paramilitaries where he lived. He was actually in County Tyrone in the Clare Valley. And that was a particularly harrowing thing for my dad and for him. And he was distressed because he had originally come from the town and his family had always done their business with my dad and his father. So,
And it's interesting that he chose to tell your dad the reason as opposed to just not coming
just
back.
Just disappearing. Exactly. And that was a measure of the man's personal integrity. And, as I say, it was distressing for everybody. The business actually in Clonus, my father's family, the family business, my brother had taken over with my mother in the end, and it eventually went out of business because the economic uncertainty, the loss of trade, and it has been measured as something like 80% of the retail trade disappeared in Clonus Town, and a lot of the businesses closed over the years. It's never had a chance to recover, and now this is what it's faced with, Brexit.
Dara MacDonald, author of Hard Border, with Richard Curran. But I leave you now with a familiar song from Eurovision hopeful Ryan O'Shaughnessy and Eurovision winners Paul Harrington and Charlie McGettigan. They sang live on The Ray D'Arcy Show on Thursday. Gurmahagavasur Goluther, Gazian Chachtan Chahugin, Gajeshab Slan.